If I sound exhausted, if my throat's a little parched, I am exhausted. We started court at 8 a.m. this morning. Judge Deborah Nelson began listening to the attorneys' discussions at 8:30, and court began promptly at 9 a.m. It just ended at 10 p.m. at exactly 9:56, 4 minutes before 10 p.m. tonight, which means we've been working since 8 a.m. this morning, and we just finished at 10 p.m. tonight. It was an unbelievable day. There wasn't anything that didn't go on. And the attorneys are still arguing to bring in evidence they feel is legitimate. And there are others that want to keep information out of the courtroom because they feel that the information is prejudicial to one side or another. Today, George Zimmerman's side brought in Susan Constantine. Susan Constantine is a body language expert. But don't forget that while she's a professional body language expert and goes to trials to examine the behavior and the messages people are giving with their body language, she didn't come in to the court to look at body language to benefit both sides. She was brought into this case by George Zimmerman's side, so her viewpoints sometimes may be slanted in one direction or the other. Because she's not brought in by the court. She's brought in by the defense, by Don West and Mark O'Mara. In any case, we interviewed her today, and here is her interview, and we will be followed by Eric Dubois, attorney at law, and myself. Here is Susan Constantine. This is Syndicated News in Sanford, Florida. We're interviewing Susan Constantine, body language expert, jury consultant.
Tell us, what about George Zimmerman's body language?
Well, different kinds of variations of his demeanor throughout, but for the most part, what I'm noticing is that he's very controlled, he's very composed. You might notice that his eyes seem to kind of droop down a little bit, and then he kind of fights sleeping. So when I'm watching him, even though he's trying to remain very in control of himself, I think personally that he's either on an antidepressant or he's been drugged or something. He's taking some sort of medication that is causing him to kind of defocus, and I can see this in his eyes, the very slow eye movement closures and then the rapid eye blinking to try to force himself to wake up again. But that's been very consistent throughout.
And I was wondering, they are talking about Trayvon Martin having THC in his bloodstream. How is it that someone who's taking psychotropics like temazepam and Adderall, which it's understood and proven that George takes these daily, how does a person with that type of medication actually get a concealed weapons permit? I didn't know that that was possible.
On the demeanor of the jury, I can speak to what goes into jury selection, what the jury might be thinking, and also analyzing all of the witnesses that are in this case.
Were you here yesterday when they had the string of witnesses?
Yes.
Could you tell us something about what for instance, let's just take one at random. Let's say the air marshal. What was his demeanor? His best friend that wrote the book.
Well, first of all, he has a law enforcement background.
The demeanor of the air marshal.
Yes. Okay. When I was watching the air marshal, first of all, we know that there's a strong relationship there. When he talks about George Zimmerman, you can actually see his face light up. So there is that likability. You tend to notice that. And what we see is that flushing of his face, the smiling. He's leaning forward into the audience because he wants to be able to convince them and convey information about how he felt about George Zimmerman and also their friendship throughout the years. But I really found that his demeanor was credible.
I thought it was believable. I also thought that he had great rapport with the audience. I think he came across very likable, and that's a really important element that you have to have as a witness, that you're kind of enrolling and bringing in people. Because remember now, we've got six jurors there standing in fate of our defendant, George Zimmerman. So anyone that knows Zimmerman and is a personal friend is a reflection of you. So we saw actually just the opposite with Trayvon Martin, with his star witness. And when you're looking at the different contrast of the different kind of lifestyles, the demeanor, we had our star witness in the state case, and she was defiant, she was rebellious, she was hostile. And on the flip side, we're watching all these other witnesses that know George, worked with him, were friends with him. He had a great impact in every single one of these people's lives because they were actually literally coming in and rescuing him, buying him suits, buying him ties, raising money for them, buying books, writing books, and they're all putting it into this fund for George Zimmerman. Well, if you had a bad relationship with people and you're known to be hostile and angry and have ill will and spite and hatred, those type of things, you're not going to have the friends that he has. So what I noticed is that this was really more about character witnesses that were all there line after line, leaving an impact with that jury that he was not the person that the state has been painting him. He's a very likable guy. He's approachable. He's not a hothead. He's not a cop wannabe. He was a guy where two people were in the wrong place at the wrong time, where two worlds collided.
There's different varying degrees of manslaughter. So with that being said, they're going to be given very specific instructions, and that's what they're going to take back in deliberations. And they're going to decide, based on the law, what best suits all the evidence they've heard before them. So my feeling was, as a jury consultant, generally speaking, we're looking for the state, we're looking for those very authoritarian people, people that can actually just, you know, first-degree murder, second-degree murder, no problem. They're supervisors, managers, or people that can take charge and make decisions that way. But when you look at this case, it's different because we want, on the state side, to have empathy. Because there's not a lot of really convincing evidence that links him to committing a crime with the intent to kill Trayvon Martin. Okay? So with that being said, now we have six female jurors. Okay? With six female jurors, knowing that they tend to be empathetic, two people, of course, that are strong caretakers, they have lots of animals, they're rescue animals, those type of people tend to be very kinesthetic, very feeling-like. So when you're feeling like, who are they going to feel more empathy for?
For Trayvon. And then when you're feeling, you tend not to be as rational.
Exactly. When
more
you're
emotional.
More emotional, you're not as rational. We have one juror. She's a 70-year-old woman who I think she'll be the foreperson. I watched her all the way through the voir dire process, through pre-publicity to general voir dire. And she has been a supervisor, a director over 1,700 people. She's very articulate. She's methodical. She's a really great critical thinker. She's balanced. She looks at everything in a balance. I think that she is going to be our foreperson. But I think that she is going to be the anchor in this jury pool, laying everything all out and trying to connect the dots as it relates to the court's instruction and what the law says. Okay? But we've got another jurors on here. We've got a blonde that's on here that has some DV, domestic violence background. She's been arrested. She's kind of flighty. She is constantly asking questions to clarification. During jury selection, she's leaning in, always leaning in so that the cameras are focused on her. She's very wants people to kind of notice her a lot. The problem with this juror, in my opinion, is she's a firecracker. She is one that she will tend to overanalyze and overanalyze and overanalyze to the point where she can't really make a decision. And I can also see her being stubborn. Like at one moment she'll say, I understand, I agree. And then she'll say, but I don't know, what about this other stuff? So I think that she's going to be a problem.
I think her husband had guns. And
yeah,
she seemed to be more on the conservative side, if you may. Will that play a role? Even though she might be flighty, like you say, or might be undecided, maybe. would that play a role?
Well, it's not just what we're doing. Let me share with you what I do. It's not just body language. We're watching the nonverbal cues, but we're also looking for the verbal cues. So it's both verbal and nonverbal. Now we're going to take into consideration their demographic backgrounds, what they did for a living, what are their skill set, their level of their education, their age, you know, the ethnicity, all of those things. We can determine when they tend to be more authoritarian or egalitarian, more pro-defense or more pro-prosecution. It's scientific jury selection. I know what we look for on both sides, okay, because I, for many years, worked in for JuryQuest as in court doing data entry for scientific jury selection. Now let's take that component, let's put that off to the side, and now let's just look at their demeanor. What are they saying, or how are they responding when they hear certain information? For example, yesterday when we had one of the witnesses testify, it was the lead investigator stated that it was Trayvon Martin's voice, and his father had said that that was not my son, if you recall. Mm-hmm. So after that was spoken, I noticed that one of the jurors, who is the one that has 8 children, 7 of them which are under the age of 18, she's Hispanic, comes from Chicago, so she's used to bang, bang, stop lots of crime. When she heard that, she nodded her head, yes. That was her nail in the coffin for her, okay? That made a lot of sense to her. It was like, yep, it wasn't him. That was really important to me. So why is that different? So as a body language expert, I'm looking for changes in demeanor. I'm watching what their normal behavior patterns are, and I'm looking for things that are tied into content. What's spoken that was so profound that they took the time to write it down on a piece of paper? What was said at that time that you saw maybe a shift in their body language or leaning in, or maybe they're thinking, or maybe they're contemplating, or maybe they're thinking, or you know, they're doing steeple positions? I'm looking for those changes because it's not just a gesture, and you just pull a gesture out and going, oh, that's what that means and what it is interpreted. That's really an inappropriate way to ever analyze anybody. You have to tie the strings together, and that is where we look for clues. It's no different than this case that they're taking everything, all the evidence, and they're painting a picture for you. The body language is the same thing. You're just trying to put the pieces together and creating a storyline, what's happening nonverbally. You're reading emotions of people because their nonverbals, their gestures and so forth is nothing more than their emotions revealed. What they're thinking creates an emotion, and then you see it leak out through their nonverbals. And that's what I'm looking for and tie it into what content's being spoken and what's important to them. And then I can see, oh, this person I think is more pro-defense. This one's more pro-prosecution. The other part of that is looking at the jurors and finding out who are mirroring each other. You know, jurors that tend to mirror each other's body language, meaning they may cross their leg the same way, they may lean more into one of the jurors, they tend to mirror each other synergistically, we find that they tend to build rapport. And when they build rapport, there's, you know, when you're in a room with the same people for a month or more, you get to know them pretty well when you can't watch TV and you can't, you know, you can't go out and do stuff. So you have just that one-on-one time. And people that tend to connect together tend to vote the same.
Thank you so much. And you are?
Susan Constantine, body language expert and jury consultant.
Or another group or another attorney needs your services, he could reach you at?
It's www.susanconstantine.com. My name is Susan Constantine. I'm a jury consultant, and I'm here on syndicatednews.net.
Eric, are you with us?
I'm here.
Thank you. Raise your voice just a touch or come closer to the phone.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. How far better? Are you from the phone, actually?
Oh, no. It's right here. Is that better?
Oh, much better. Absolutely.
Okay, good.
That was some explanation on body language, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's one of the best. And she's,
yes, she is. And she studied the jurors one at a time with an eagle eye. Well, as you know, court ended 2 minutes ago. Did you see that?
Unfortunately, I've heard, but I didn't see. I know.
We started at 8 a.m. and ended at 10 p.m. I moved the show from 9 p.m. I kept moving it back a few minutes, and I realized we're not going to make it. We're going to have to move it to 10 o'clock. And luckily, Blog Talk Radio, in their inimitable wisdom, helped me make all the changes, because I kept trying to change it and move it, and I wasn't able to, and they stepped in and helped me. By the way, we have made a formal verification. There are no other Blog Talk Radio hosts legally registered to cover this trial in the courthouse, registered as a member of the media, other than syndicated news. If I haven't told you that before, I'm making the official announcement now.
Very good.
We are in the media room. We call it the syndicated newsroom. We share it with National Public Radio, Univision, and sometimes Telemundo, and every now and again with Associated Press. And yesterday, we had a wonderful visit from Orlando Sentinel. That was a lot of fun. And this week, we're chasing down Renee Stuffman. We're going to see if we can't get her to talk to us. She already said yes. As well as, we are scheduling now, we're working out the details. We will be interviewing Angela Corey. We've already interviewed Benjamin Crump, and now we're going to interview Angela Corey. So it should be very interesting. Eric, are there any people at this trial that you feel we should talk to?
No, I think you've hit all the major. Obviously, once the case is over and the jury comes back, I think it would be interesting to talk to, you know, the state attorneys that try the case, as well as, you know, Mark O'Meara and Don West, and try.
Oh, absolutely.
No, as in right now, you've hit all the major players, so.
And I asked them to take the list, and I asked, let's go down this list. I'd like to see which other Blog Talk Radio hosts are here. And there are none. We're it. We're the only Blog Talk Radio host at the trial. Well, we are syndicated news.net, of course. We are legally licensed as a news and media company in the state of Florida and Malaysia, in the state of Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. So if you visit syndicatednews.net, you'll find that anything you find there can be translated to more than 200 languages. And I guess lots of people are coming here to discuss take on one argument or another. There are very many viewpoints to the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman murder trial. Eric, what do you see coming?
I think that we're probably one or two witnesses away from the defense resting. I think you're going to see them call John Good again. And we have this animation. Did the judge rule tonight? Or
no. Did you see the animation? The animation was basically built on George Zimmerman's imagination.
Right.
That's really unfair to take the one person who's still alive and take his memory of how things went. Naturally, he's going to memorialize the events in the manner which benefits him most.
Right, and I think what you saw the defense was arguing is that it also was based on some of the testimony of the Lauer 911 tape, John Good, you know, his testimony, and they kind of pieced it all together to create that animation. I don't necessarily know if the defense really needs the animation as part of its, you know, in evidence. I think the defense would be just as well off if they just used it in their closing argument to show what they, you know, how they interpret the facts and how they see the evidence laying out as a demonstrative aid as opposed to being evidence. I don't know if they, with with all the witnesses and how this case is kind of unraveled for the state, in my opinion, I don't know if they necessarily even need that animation if it's such a critical decision.
Well, we've got six jurors that have had a life experience of their own, and they're listening to every bit of evidence and everything that's being said, and at every opportunity when Judge Deborah Nelson has offered to go ahead and send them on back and relax and take this up tomorrow, they absolutely refuse. They say, nope, let's hear it now. Let's get it out of the way.
Right.
They want to proceed. They do not want to waste any more time.
Right. You know, imagine being cooped up in a hotel room for 3 weeks, away from your family, away from television, away from the internet, away from everything, you know, that you've come to know as your normal daily life, and being told what you can eat, when you can wake up, when you can go to bed, what TV shows you can watch. It's basically you're in prison, and it's brutal. It's part of, you know, why the jury sequestration is not often done, and it's why typically once a jury is sequestered, they kind of plow through the evidence and have hearings late at night, early in the morning, so that you're not wasting the jury's time, and you can get in full 8-hour, 9-hour days of testimony. It's part of the reason, frankly, I'm kind of surprised that the judge didn't have court on Saturdays, at least half a day, to try and move this thing along. But, you know, I understand there was a lot of, you know, work that had to be done and court resources that go into it. But, you know, the judge has been very conscientious of the jury's time and making sure you saw it this morning. She stopped that hearing after an hour and a half and said, we've got a jury back there. I'm not going to waste any more of their time. We're going to move on, and if we have to stay here late, we'll stay here late. And obviously they did, if they were there until almost, you know, till 10 o'clock tonight.
Till 10 o'clock tonight. She let the jury go, and she continued with these items that had to be discussed. They were
right.
So serious. Is there something wrong with the phone, or do you have a cold?
I'm fighting a little cold.
Oh, no.
Right. Yeah,
well,
I don't know if it's cold or allergies, but it's either way.
Well,
the
courtroom is kept freezing cold. It's very cold in there. So if you see people with blankets on their laps, that's the reason. Now everybody's wearing long-sleeved sweaters.
They got to keep everyone awake.
Yeah, and the chairs are particularly uncomfortable. But it's surprising.
Right.
This is so serious. They are discussing new photographs that were found in Trevon's phone. Apparently, Trevon had a software that hid messages as well as photographs. And unless you knew that the software was there and you had the code to open it, you would not have known that he had a picture of himself. Apparently, he was holding a gun, and he had a message in there, or so the defense claimed, that there was a message in there that was basically about buying or selling a gun. And very logically, Judge Nelson would not allow it, because she said right now 4- and 5-year-olds get their parents' phones and send messages out and do all sorts of wonderful things with it, and the parent is none the wiser, and there's no one to authenticate that it was Trevon himself that used that phone and wrote that message. It couldn't have been anybody else. So that's not going to come in. And now they're going back and forth with this animation, and basically the defense is stating that George's rights are being violated by the Constitution and the laws of the state of Florida because discovery was not shared with them in time. And finally, Judge Nelson, just now at 9:56 exactly, she said, "That's enough. We're in recess, and I'll see you here at 8:00 in the morning, and we'll proceed." So it was testy. It was very argumentative, and everyone's holding their ground. Excuse the pun. What do you see coming in the future, Eric?
I think you're going to have a little more of these hearings, but I think the defense will probably wrap up tomorrow. I think they'll call John Good. They may call Benjamin Crump to talk about the family meeting and the way the 911 tape was played for the family to show that it doesn't follow traditional police manner in which identification is made, to show that the family, from the defense perspective, was biased in making a determination that was Trayvon Martin yelling for help. And frankly, I don't know what else the defense has to show or has up their sleeve. But I think they're going to call John Good again because he's as close as they have to an eyewitness of this event as you're going to get in a circumstantial case. And then the state will have their rebuttal, and which I can't imagine is going to go for that long. I think this goes to the jury probably Thursday afternoon or first thing Friday morning.
Yes, apparently the defense says they're going to rest on Wednesday.
Yeah. So I think they'll rest tomorrow before lunch. And then after lunch, you'll see they'll break for lunch, and then the state will come back after lunch and start their rebuttal and their they'll probably have 3 or 4 witnesses to come in and testify, and then closing arguments Thursday afternoon, then to the jury Friday morning.
And I tell you, it's getting very, very interesting. And this time a year ago, July, we are now in the month of July, and a year ago, George Zimmerman was in jail, and he would talk to his friends, and it was quite interesting. He would talk to his wife and his relatives and his friends, and I'm wondering, when it comes to integrity and character, now, it was only Shelley that lied to the judge, who has since been recused. That was the second judge they had recused. And Shelley went ahead, and George let her. She told the judge that she knew nothing about whether there was any money in any PayPal account. She said, "I don't know. I have no idea." She said she didn't know. She understood nothing. And, well, that's a matter of integrity. She was charged. Apparently, to lie to a judge, it's a felony. She was charged with perjury. And as soon as George's trial ends, hers begins. But I have another question. While Shelley and George were on the phone working up this scheme to lie to the judge, and they would say they had $7, meaning they had $7,000, or they'd say $10, meaning $10,000, then saying things like, "Keep it under $10 to make sure that the bank doesn't, we don't attract attention from the feds. Keep it under $10, meaning $10,000. And there was one point where they were moving $10,000 every 24 hours because that was the limit. That was the limit the bank would allow. I think it was a thrift bank, something to that effect. There had a friend of theirs who was helping them move the money and helping them change the questions in the bank system to get into the bank to move money because the bank wanted, or rather George wanted Shelley to be able to get at the money herself, and he wanted to make sure she had at least $100,000 in there in case she needs it. And that's when they discussed making sure to have his to have a passport, one of his passports, because he had an American one and another one from Peru. They wanted to make sure he had a passport in the bank box. By the way, we're not inventing what I just said. We're not inventing it. These are discussions that George Zimmerman had with his wife, Shelley Zimmerman, while he was in jail. He thought that because I guess they're married that their conversations were private. I don't know who in their right mind would think that discussing anything in the jail is private. There's no right to privacy. You're already in trouble. You're in jail. You have no right to privacy. And they held her in contempt and charged her with perjury. Now, there was another man, a friend of theirs, that was with them on the phone call, helping her basically obstruct justice, as far as I'm concerned, helping her scheme this out. Now, I understand if you hold the door open for a bank robber, you might as well have robbed the bank yourself. Isn't that person just as responsible, the one who was helping them move money secretly behind the judge's back? Isn't that person also as responsible as they were for fooling the judge? What do you say, Eric? What's the law?
I don't believe so. The person, you know, who was helping had to know that what the intent was behind.
Yeah, they knew.
You know, Shelley.
Oh, they absolutely knew, which is why they spoke in code.
But I don't think you heard that person talking to Shelley and George. I think it was more
yes,
just Shelley
yes,
and
I
George
did.
Talking.
No. I have the tape. I have the tape. The three of them are talking to each other.
Well,
and
I don't
he is asking. I have the tape. I'll give it to you. George is asking
his
friend.
I mean, you're asking me if that person's going to be as responsible in charge of perjury, and I'm saying I don't believe so because that person never testified under oath. And
no.
It's really not an obstruction of justice issue. She's not charged with obstructing justice. She's charged with perjury. And the perjury was whether or not she knowingly lied to the judge at the bond hearing. And that's not obstructing justice. And the person who was assisting in moving money or anything wasn't doing anything wrong at that time because they weren't under any subpoena or under oath to testify as to what was going on. I mean, the only reason she was in trouble is because she was under oath and asked, how much money do you have? She said she didn't know, and now the state's bringing out, you know, this evidence to show that she knew how much they had, but it's not an obstruction of justice issue. I mean, obstruction of justice would have been if, you know, they would have destroyed evidence or tampered with some of the evidence in this case to make it fit a certain way. But that, you know, helping someone withdraw money and deposit money into different accounts isn't obstruction of justice, in my opinion, and it's not perjury either.
It's not perjury?
When did that person testify? That person was never asked to testify and never sworn
under
oath.
No, that person. Right. That person was never asked. You're right. That person was never asked to testify. And that person, knowing full well that he was participating in something that the court did not approve of. I mean, you don't need to break a specific law if you know that there's a law against something. No one had to tell me, you know, don't rob the bank. I know not to rob the bank.
I don't think there's anything that the court didn't approve of. I think the court didn't approve of Shelley misrepresenting in the court's opinion or in the, you know, the state's opinion that she didn't know what was going on. There's nothing illegal about taking money out of one account and putting it in another account. What's illegal is representing that you don't know how much money there is or, you know, lying to the
saying
court.
Saying that you don't know that there's any money at all, saying that you're broke and for that reason you want the cheap bond.
But that third party didn't do anything wrong. There's no problem. If I have my money, if I have a bank account at Bank of America and I ask you to help me move it from Bank of America to Chase, and then the court asks me, Mr. DuBois, how much money do you have? And I say, I don't have any money in my Bank of America account. you're under no obligation to tell the court, well, Your Honor, you know, I helped them move money to this Chase account. I'm the one who's under oath. I'm the one who's being asked the questions. You're not, there's no obligation of you to come forward and say, this is, you know, this is what I know. And there's nothing wrong with you helping me move money.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree with you. I'm just wondering, if I were the employer of that third party that was on the phone call, I would be concerned with that person's integrity. Like I said, you don't have to rob the bank if you hold the door open for the thief. Well, he carries on the theft. I would be concerned with that person's integrity.
Well, I mean,
true?
Not necessarily. I mean, what they did, they didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing sinister or nothing wrong in what they were doing. You know, helping someone move money from one account to another bank account, as long as it's legal and as long as it's all declared, you know, it's not like you're moving money from one account in the United States to an offshore account in the Cayman Islands. That's illegal. But moving money from one bank account to another bank account in a different, you know, registered bank, I don't see the problem with it. But, you know, no one's ever going to hear about that. The jury in the George Zimmerman case is never going to hear about that. My suspicion is once this case is done, depending on the outcome, the Shelley Zimmerman case will go away relatively quickly, and it'll all be water under the bridge.
This is great. You said the Shelley case will go away very quickly, the perjury case?
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Teach us about that. We're totally unfamiliar. How will it go away? Teach us.
They'll reach some sort of plea agreement, or you know, the state will drop the charges, or she'll reach some plea agreement. Right now, I mean, there's no incentive right now for anyone to do any negotiating or come to any resolution. And you know, honestly, in my opinion, if the state gets a conviction in the George Zimmerman case, they're going to have their pound of flesh, and you'll probably see it just kind of go away.
They'll just drop the case against her, won't they?
If they don't drop it, it would be knocked down for something very minor. But if he's acquitted, I think she'll do some plea. She'll never spend a day in jail. And it'll go away, and you know, in 6 months, people in Sanford won't be talking about Shelley Zimmerman. They'll be talking about, you know, what happened, and you know, the change of Elmo.
Do you think this case is strong enough to stay to keep George free? Do you think the defense's position is strong enough to keep him out of jail? Because any way you cut it, now if what he's been charged with, which is
second degree murder,
he's looking at 25 to life. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can he plead to a lesser charge?
Yeah, if the state would offer. I mean, if. And, you know, I don't know if it were plea negotiations. I'm sure there were plea negotiations, and I'm sure, you know, there were offers to, you know, lesser included. He could, you know, if the state wanted to, they could plead him to manslaughter. But I think from day one, George Zimmerman was, you know, entered a plea of not guilty and maintained that, you know, and maintains that today. Is the defense case strong enough? I mean, if you're looking at it from, you know, as a defense attorney like I am, there's a ton of reasonable doubt. There's a ton of, you know, John Good's testimony alone creates doubt and creates, you know, some issues for the state that the state, frankly, has started to retreat and abandon from as to who was on top and who was on the bottom. Vinny DiMaio's testimony today about the gunshot and about the burn on the outer shirt versus the entry wound on the other shirt versus the entry wound on the chest, you know, shows that Trayvon Martin presumably was on top and that his one sweatshirt was distanced from his body, which could be, which fits into what George Zimmerman, essentially his testimony, his reenactment video supports, that Trayvon was on top and beating him down, and he reached for his gun and pulled it out and shot. What it also supports is, it can't support a theory that George Zimmerman, that Trayvon Martin was pulling away, and that George Zimmerman grabbed his sweatshirt and pulled him closer, because then George Zimmerman would have the ability to outstretch his arm and put his arm all the way up to his chest and push the one shirt into the other shirt and then pull the trigger. And basically what you got today from the defense medical examiner was that he basically just pulled his gun out of the holster, lifted up and squoze right next to George Zimmerman's chest. And it was very close. It wasn't at a up into, pressed into Trayvon Martin. So from a reasonable doubt perspective, there's doubt. If the jury wants to acquit, they can hang their hat on that. You've got the professor from Seminole State College who talked about and basically gave a law lecture to the jury on stand your ground and self-defense, and basically articulated to the jury, you know, what the difference is between the two, and that there's such things in Florida as imperfect self-defense and imperfect stand your ground, where even though you may be the aggressor initially, you may be justified in the use of deadly force in the end if the person who you started something with used unreasonable force and deadly force against you and your life was in danger. Dr. DeMaio today talked about the abrasions and the lacerations on the back of his head being consistent with, you know, someone's head getting beat against the concrete, which doesn't give and is a hard surface. And there's no forgiveness, and there's often other brain injuries that are done below the surface that aren't visible to the eye.
I'm sorry. I understand that he spoke about that today, but it, you know, we're in the courtroom, man. Let me tell you, that looked really lame. It sounded really lame. He was ready to, they were ready to say to poor Georgie, oh, by the way, his name is Georgie now, not George. Poor Georgie has suffered from shaken baby syndrome.
But,
his
but
laceration, that's the expression used, laceration, for scratches. The scratches, one of them was a 16th of an inch. You know how small that is? So small were his two scratches that they did not require a suture, neither of them.
But here's what you're going to hear the defense argue in closing arguments.
Yes, tell us.
It doesn't matter how big the wound was. What matters is what George Zimmerman reasonably perceived was happening or was about to happen to him. He's under no obligation to take out a ruler and measure and say, oh, the wound is less than an inch, I can't do anything about it. Or the wound is less than a half an inch, I can't do anything about this. Unfortunately, you've only got George Zimmerman who could testify because Trayvon Martin's passed. But it's what he reasonably perceived at that moment in time as to what was happening or what was about to happen. And what you're going to see the defense argue is that he perceived that had he not taken the actions he did, this abuse and the constant beating of his head against the concrete, the punches to the face, would not have stopped. And he was in this ground and pound, you know, position where he was the recipient. He was not in a dominant position, and he was receiving the blows, which is consistent with what John Good testified to. And I think what you're going to see John Good come back for one more time to reiterate again to the jury, it was the person in the dark gray hoodie that was on top throwing down blows and doing this maneuver. And I would not be surprised if you see Mark O'Mara or Don West on the ground again doing a reenactment of show me how it was, because that kind of stuff sticks with the jury, and all the defense needs to do is convince one person on that jury that there's of some reasonable doubt that he was justified in defending himself and that he had a right to do what he did, and you've got an acquittal. And that's all the defense needs to do is convince one. The state
and
needs to convince all six.
I wanted to ask you a question about THC found in Trayvon Martin's bloodstream. apparently they have found traces, not out and out pot, but traces, light traces in his bloodstream of THC, which is a component of weed, of marijuana. Now, I listened to the tapes every night as they were compiled of George in jail talking with his wife and his friends and his neighbors and whoever else called him. And I remember that he insisted that his meds had to be brought in. He's taking a form of temazepam, and he's also taking Adderall. Adderall is for ADHD, attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity disorder, and the temazepam apparently is for panic attacks. They are not over-the-counter drugs. They are prescription drugs. They fall under the category of psychotropics, and they can only be prescribed by psychiatrists. I didn't know that if a person was on that serious a drug regimen, that that individual could also apply for and get a concealed weapons permit. What about that? What's the story with that? Could you teach us about that tonight?
Well, there's no, you know, there's no mental health evaluations. There's no, I mean, your background check for a concealed weapons permit is essentially a criminal background check to make sure that there's no, you know, that you have a right to carry a firearm and that there's no outstanding charges or you haven't been convicted of something that would prevent you from being able to carry a firearm. I mean, there's no mental health.
That's excellent. I just heard what you said. Now, George Zimmerman had several problems with the law, and he had several where he had accepted a diversionary program so that the felonies would not go up against his name, would not be on his permanent record. But it doesn't mean that he didn't commit the crimes for which he was charged. It meant that he accepted, he did not contest it, he accepted it, and he accepted the diversion program. Usually you do some volunteer work in town, you see a psychologist, things of that nature. He did all that and accepted the fact that he was in the wrong, and he did all that so that he wouldn't have the felony added to his name, to his permanent file. It doesn't mean he didn't commit the crime. It just means that he did the diversion program to avoid having the felony attached to his permanent record. A person like that who has already showed a defiance to a law enforcement officer, I didn't know that a person like that, there's no mental health check to get. So wait a minute. So if you smoke weed and that's found in your bloodstream, that's a problem if a gun's involved. But if you are on psychotropic drugs issued by a psychiatrist, there's no problem. Is that correct?
Correct. And let me correct one thing. Just because someone enters a pretrial diversion program or accepts a diversion program is not an admission of guilt. I have a number of clients that get offered diversionary programs and will take the diversionary programs because they would prefer to do that than run the risk of going to trial, because you never know what's going to happen at trial. You never know what a jury is going to find. And often these diversionary programs are set up where, you know, they help people, and people may acknowledge that they need some help, but the offense goes away. It's not on your record, and it's not a conviction. That can't be used against someone later. You entered this diversionary program, and you know that means you're really convicted, but you know there's nothing on your record. And with regards to part of the issue why anything with regards to George Zimmerman's background isn't coming in is because you can't use his prior bad acts to attack his character. His character isn't in question, one, because he hasn't testified, and two, there's been no
evidence. I'm so glad you mentioned that. It can't come in because it's a prior bad act. In other words, you can't use acts that show a propensity of behavior, correct?
Unless the state attorney's office can convince the judge that these events are so similarly related that it shows a pattern. But he was, there were two domestic violence, I think there was a domestic violence injunction that he had against
two.
Right. But those are civil. They're not criminal. There was a battery on a law enforcement officer, which was the pretrial diversion. So there's no conviction. And you also have no one to testify to bring that stuff in through because George Zimmerman's not going to take the stand.
Okay, then if that be true, if what you're saying is the case, then I have to ask, why then are they bringing in the fact that there's THC in Trayvon's bloodstream when we don't get to bring in the fact that there's temazepam and Adderall, which are far more drug serious than weed?
Okay, first of all, to my knowledge, there was no blood drawn or toxicology reports done on George Zimmerman the night of the incident. So we don't know if he was on those medications. Even though I know this stuff stays in your system for a while, we don't know his levels. Second of all, the THC level, as the defense argued, is relevant for Trayvon Martin because...
Why?
Because THC and use of marijuana can cause someone to act irrational, cause them to make, you know, decision-making implications. And what they're saying is these events, that from the defense perspective, these events could have not happened had when Bruce Zimmerman approached Trayvon Martin and said, what are you doing here? He said, hey, I'm going back home, and he walked. But instead, from the defense perspective, Trayvon Martin was the aggressor, and he took the first shot. And from the defense perspective, they're saying part of that was because he was on drugs. The problem for the defense is that the THC levels were so low that THC stays in your system for 30 days. If you smoke marijuana today, in 20 days, it's still going to show up and you'd still fail a drug test. So
Wow. You're
going to have experts, you're going to have a battle of the experts saying how quickly the THC level diminish in the bloodstream, et cetera, and get out of your body to show that. I think that's what, you know, if the defense brings this in, that's what one of the, probably you're going to see the state rebut and say, this THC level was so far so low that the marijuana use was so much earlier than this event that his actions would have never been affected by that, and it's completely irrelevant. But, you know, even if the defense doesn't bring that up, they've created and they've turned so many of the state witnesses into defense witnesses that I don't know how the state's going to overcome some of these hurdles that they've put up for themselves, you know, to get a murder two conviction. A manslaughter, you know, the threshold's a lot lower, obviously, but, you know, if the jury believes that George Zimmerman was right in standing his ground and was right in the use of deadly force as a form of self-defense, there's not a different standard for murder two versus manslaughter. Self-defense is self-defense. If you're justified once, you're justified in another event. So that's my opinion. I don't know. But, you know, look, we've all been, you know, picking these things is difficult. I know you've got a 50-50 shot, but we're all wrong.
Is there any way that he can minimize the danger that he's in, George Zimmerman? Because one thing I asked his brother to do was to stop tweeting those racist tweets that he would send out on his Twitter program, and they were extremely offensive.
What do you mean minimize the incident?
Is there anything else that George can do to mitigate, to lessen the danger he's in? Can he plead to a lesser charge?
He could plead to a lesser included, but I mean, right now I think he's got to like where he stands. He's got to like the way the trial's been going. I know the defense is happy with the way the trial's going. They've said that on the record to different media outlets, that they're happy with the way the testimony's gone. And I'd be stunned if he entered a plea deal at this late in the game.
Really? You think so?
I'd be stunned if he did. I don't think he will. This is going to a jury, and the jury's going to come back with a verdict.
I just don't know. I just think it's too severe. I don't see how they could ignore the. I read people. I read their faces and their eyebrows and what they do with their. You know, Susan reads Constantine. She reads body language. I just read facial expressions, and I got to tell you, it doesn't look very good. I would be very concerned if I were Mark O'Mara or Don West.
No, I mean, we all thought the jury in the Casey Anthony was going to find her guilty. Everyone said
it didn't look good for her. Wasn't that something?
So,
wow.
You know, you can't read a jury, and that's the hard part about these. It's a big chess game, and I think, you know, there's a lot of testimony, and I think, you know, this is going to come down to the closing arguments, and I think you're going to see two very good closing arguments. You know, obviously one from the state, one from the defense, and I think it's going to come down to, you know, whose side is more credible, which witnesses make more sense. And I think, you know, the way the defense has gone, they're going to use a lot of the state's witnesses to bolster their side of the story. And
Yes, they are.
You know, and that's the situation. I mean, the state's medical examiner, when he testified that Trayvon Martin could have been alive for anywhere between 1 to 10 minutes, that totally fit into what the defense theory was, is that Trayvon Martin moved his hands back under his chest after George Zimmerman spread him out and made sure he didn't have any weapons and essentially cleared him, and then he moved him back under. And
You believed that?
That's what the state's medical examiner said, that he could have been alive for 1 to 10 minutes. That's the evidence, that's the testimony.
Yeah, it was hard for me to believe that. Yep, I understand.
It's hard to believe it, but there's nothing to contradict that. There's nothing that said he died immediately and died on, you know, as soon as the gunshot was fired. Both the state and the defense expert both testified he could have been alive. And when the state's expert's testifying that he could have been alive, and that supports the defense theory, what more does the jury need? If someone wanted to find reasonable doubt and wanted to acquit, there's so many different hooks that they can hang their hat on.
Yes,
and that's what
I think the state
has a hard time.
Well, it was a heck of a day today. The discussions would go back and forth, and frankly, when I look at people's eyebrows and how they express it, the way they turn corners, their mouths, for instance, things of that nature. I worry a lot. And it just seemed very, very hot and heavy today. It was unbelievable. What a great day. Very exciting. And we'll be back here next week on Trial Tuesday. Eric, will you come back with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think you'll be talking about this trial. I think it's going to be done on Friday.
You think that the jury will be done by Friday?
Yeah. If they get the case in the morning, I don't think they're going to deliver it more than 8 or 9 hours.
Okay. All right, you heard it here first. We'll see you next week. This is syndicatednews.net with Blog Talk Radio and Eric Dubois.
Take care. Have a good night.
Take care. Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Eric. Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.